My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
You're listening to 100 Words or Less with Ray Harkins.
Welcome, everybody, to the year of our Lord 2024 and continuing to put out podcasts about people who are involved in independent music, whether that is punk, hardcore, indie rock, emo, whatever it is. Screamo, I could probably come up with some more genres. My new favorite one, as I've heard as of late, invented or maybe wrongly attributed that he invented this, but you know, maybe he'll wear it proudly as a baddie core, which I dare you to Google and go down that rabbit hole. Friend of the show, Craig Reynolds, the drummer for Stray from the Path, does an amazing podcast called Downbeat. Anyways, putting all that aside, if this is your first time here, welcome. If this is your, 100th time here, awesome. If this is your 500th time here, that's probably really only me. But I mean, if you've listened to 500 episodes of this thing, holy moly, I'm eternally indebted to you. And you've probably spent more time with me than my wife has. I don't know, maybe that's probably mischaracterizing it. But anyways, I digress. And I am incredibly excited about this episode today because this is a person who I've tried to go about getting on the show for quite some time. So I have Nick Pye from the legendary Ontario screamo, indie rock, whatever you want to call it, band called Shotmaker, who just released a brand new beautiful box set discography courtesy of Solid Brass Records. I will leave a link in the show notes in which you can go purchase that bad boy. The moment that came up for pre-order, I ordered it, even though I have all the original pressings of their seminal LPs and splits and all that stuff. Shotmaker is a really cool band because they were talking about the ground floor. I mean, they were talking about existing in the early to mid 90s and definitely paved a way for many bands to inspire their sounds based off of the weirdo noise that they were making in the, Southern Ontario, mid-level Ontario, upper area of Ontario area in Canada. They're from Ottawa. I just, wanted to paint the whole picture of the province. But Nick was so gracious and so cool to spend time with me and let me just rifle around his brain because, this is a band that I think a lot of people who have been exposed to end up loving them and are just like, why was this band mentioned in the same sentences as like Fugazi or whatever? I mean, maybe that's a little bit hyperbolic, but you get what I'm saying. And I got keyed into them pretty early once I started to explore all the beautiful regions of Ontario in regards to just all the music coming out from there. Cause I was obsessed with it. Still am obsessed with it. You've probably heard me talk about it on more than one occasion on this show, but anyways, that's all that. Shotmaker is an incredible band. You need to listen to their whole discography if you mess with anything angular, heavy-ish, just great band. So I'm trying something out this year because you love recommendations. Like the year-end list that I put up in regards to the favorite records and like what myself enjoyed, what my friend Jeremy enjoyed or what Joey enjoyed. I just get so much positive feedback that I'm going to do a little quick recommendation of the week. At the top of each episode, I am going to talk about a thing that I've been enjoying that I think you should pay attention to in some capacity. This one is sort of, I guess, jumping off of the honorable mentions episode that I did towards the tail end of last year, or actually the literal last episode of the new year, or 2023, I should say. This is released on Sunday Drive Records. The band is called Still. They put out an EP called Doomed that I have been loving. Don't get me wrong in saying the fact that this isn't reinventing the wheel, and that might sound like, you know, a disparaging thing, but it's not. It's a really, really good band. I was never previously aware of them. And then this EP, this four-song EP dropped. It was, you know, very, very late last year. And I've just been obsessively listening to it. And it's four songs, so it's a, you know, easy 12 to 14 minutes, and you just wash it down and then be like, all right, let's listen to it on repeat. But yeah, if you like Failure, you know, Hum, all those sort of bands, you will absolutely adore the band Still, and the EP is called Doomed. So there we go. One recommendation a week I'll be dropping in this little intro. So anyways, you can always email the show for your recommendations, hunterwordspodcast@gmail.com. Love to hear feedback from everybody. And you can also leave a rating and review on the Apple Podcast page. It helps out tremendously. Take the 0.4 seconds it takes for you to do that, and maybe like 30 seconds writing like a sentence or two. You can also leave a rating on the Spotify page as well. All of those things help. And you can follow along on YouTube, because I publish these episodes on a regular cadence there, and some people love to listen to podcasts on YouTube. So there we go. That's what's happening. And I will leave a link in the show notes to follow along with the show's page on YouTube. Anyways, let's talk to Nick from Shotmaker, who I, listening back to this interview, I was like, oh my gosh, I love Shotmaker so much. So anyways, check out their discography. It's up for streaming everywhere. And then, like I said, there's a link in the show notes where you can order the awesome box set on vinyl. So here we go. Started to get into like punk and hardcore probably, you know, mid-90s, so right as you guys were obviously disbanding. But being from California, I got into, you know, Ebullition Records and like that whole scene, and then I became obsessed with a lot of the greater Ontario area of music in regards to, like, you know, all the band, whatever, whether it was like Chokehold and everything Chris Callahan did, like, just, I was obsessed with that whole area. And so then Shotmaker came across my, you know, desk, so to speak, and I got into the Crayon Club LP. And I just remember I was so excited to find that out in the wild at a record store, because I knew it was like a little more difficult to find. Mm-hmm. Anyways, when I first listened to it, I was like, oh, wow, like, it's this interesting combo of, like, you know, sort of like the post-hardcore, whatever, quicksandish type stuff, Fugazi, whatever you want to call that. And then obviously what Screamo, as, you know, it became known in the later 90s. But obviously both, like, that what you guys were doing was predating that scene. I know this is probably a difficult thing to maybe articulate, but just like, who were you guys trying to rip off? Because obviously every band that when you start, you're just trying to rip off other bands. What was kind of the, you know, I guess thesis statement, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be aloof, but I kind of feel like our band, we had influences for sure. But I think as an artist, you do what you can do, not what you want to do. And I think when we were playing together, our sound was just happening kind of organically, and it didn't really sound like anyone of that time. Like, we had influences, like, obviously we loved, you know, Fugazi, and Circus Lupus was amazing. You know, the Jesus Lizard, No Means No, all of those bands, but we weren't trying to emulate, like, we weren't trying to emulate anything. We were just kind of existing. And I would say the biggest influence on our musical direction wasn't any one band. It was actually going on our first U.S. tour in 1993, where we started playing with all these bands we'd never heard of before, and it felt like there was something really urgent and important happening in that time, and it was this. You know, the music was urgent. The music was important. And I would say it was something in the water. There was just some collective thing that, You know, I think the energy of that time really influenced the music more than trying to emulate any one band. So I know it's kind of an aloof answer, but I don't think we were ever really trying to piggyback on a sound or a style. I think we were just letting ourselves kind of forge our own path a bit, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, that is a very fair response, because obviously in the, you know, pre-internet days, that you weren't, I mean, yes, you were able to, you know, understand bands' sounds based off of obviously records you get and like all those bands that you were citing, but there definitely isn't that idea where you can just be like, you know, like when I started my first band, I was like, oh yeah, I want to be, you know, Unbroken meets Snapcase or whatever. And like, that was pre-internet as well, but like you were just trying to like pull these influences, even though whatever you were trying to rip off sounded nothing like it because you just weren't that good or whatever. But I understand exactly what you're saying, where it's just like, oh, it's mostly you following those impulses and energy rather than articulating like, oh yes, here are the, you know, seven bands that we want to like rip off or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think if you're like into, like, you hear about like athletes talking about dissecting their game and things, and they study other people's performance, and, you know, they take the shot of this person or, you know, the dribble of that person or something. And yeah, I don't think we were doing that. It was more of an energy we were responding to. It was, you know, and we were from Ontario, and in Ontario, we were from a small town. We weren't from like Toronto at that time when we were starting, and there was nothing really to do but skateboard and play music. And so essentially we spent a lot of time together, just, you know, we would practice sometimes two times a day, three times a day, because we'd, you know, be at Matt's house, we'd, you know, build a jump outside for, you know, snowboarding or something, you know, go hit that for a couple of hours, come back in, practice again. And we spent like every waking moment kind of together, and we had a good chemistry as friends. And I think that that's really what helped define the music and the rhythm. I think we were really in sync, and I'm not sure if that happens many times in your life, but we, you know, the three of us spent a lot of time together, and I feel like we were just really in sync with each other. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll pull on some of those threads a little bit later, but you yourself, were you actually born and raised in Ontario? I know, like you said, you kind of came up in a small town and you guys eventually moved to Ottawa, but where were you born and raised?
I was born in England. I was born in Torquay, and I moved to the Belleville area probably 1980. So I was about four at that time. And Matt and Tim are both from the Belleville area. Yeah.
Okay. And I presume you probably have no memories whatsoever of England.
I do. I mean, I was four, but not like more feelings, nothing concrete. Right. But yeah, I do. And yeah, go back a lot too. So it's hard to distinguish what I know now from what I knew then, because memory is this, you know, kind of a formless thing. So,
right, exactly. And especially the idea where it's like, you know, whether it's you're remembering the stories told to you versus like, oh yeah, I actually remember that myself. It's like, right. You know, we are what is told to us.
Absolutely.
And from what I understand, your, you know, household makeup, as far as like do you have two older sisters, and like were mom and dad in the house and everything like that?
I had three older sisters. I think the eldest was seven years older than me, so I was the youngest. So I grew up with three older sisters. And mom and dad were around for a bit, and then, you know, not together for quite a while too. So it was a normal home. I think the 80s, you know, some amazing music came out of the 80s. So I grew up with, like, when I was very young, like, you know, kind of pinching my sister's records and, you know, getting influenced. Like, I think in grade four, I was really into, you know, Dead Kennedys. I think the first album I bought was Frankenchrist when I was in grade four. And, you know, so I was hearing all that kind of music and influence, like, really early on, because my older sisters, obviously, right?
Yeah. Totally. Well, and I think that, I mean, you being the, you know, baby of the bunch, like all you have to do as far as, you know, trying to find anything quote unquote cool is, you know, looking to older siblings, or maybe obviously if your parents know what's up, they're showing you little things here and there. So yeah, it's cool that you could just sneak into their room and be like, well, I wonder what this is. What's this?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Music was so great in the 80s. You know, you had that sort of the real post first wave punk, like, you know, The Cure and all those bands. And I remember my sisters being really into new wave, like Depeche Mode, and, you know, that having a big influence on me when I was young, but also like, you know, those bands, they just felt, for some reason, it felt arm in arm with punk rock too. You know, it was, you know, just, it made sense to listen to like the Dead Kennedys when you were listening to The Cure. Just, I didn't see like a huge separation to that because I had kind of an eclectic mix from, you know, the different range of sisters I had, I guess.
Sure. And I mean, in retrospect, like when you start to get older and have perspective on where those bands and artists were coming from, it's like, yes, the linkage between, you know, new wave or whatever you want to call it of the 80s. And then obviously punk, like, you know, they were branches on the same tree.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what kind of kid did you find yourself, you know, being like, did you care about school? Were you doing, you know, the prerequisite, you have to play hockey because you're from Canada. Like what did you find yourself getting into?
No hockey for me. But, I was okay at school, I guess. I didn't really overthink school. I finished all my schooling, you know, and I went on to do multiple kind of degrees at university as well. So school wasn't hard for me, but I didn't really have anything I cared too much about at school, like subject-wise. I was more interested in, I guess when I was young, skateboarding, like really interested in skateboarding. So that was what I did, like, is every waking moment. And then kind of music came along, grade 9-ish for me. Although I'd been like into hardcore and everything and punk rock well before then, like grade 9 was when I started playing in the band. And then high school really took a back seat to my touring. So touring in Shotmaker was really like, you know, the first and foremost thing that I, you know, did and was interested in. And school, I guess, kind of suffered through those 4 years of high school. I didn't really put too much work into it, but you know, later on in life I returned to academia and am a university professor now, so it's kind of an interesting full circle. But not super, didn't focus on my studies too much, but I was really into like skateboarding and subculture sports, like when we were skateboarding in the 80s and 90s, like it was like being a punk. Like, you're in a small town, you would get chased by the jocks. It was basically a Dead Kennedys song, right? It was a subculture of its own, and it was kind of special, you know. It brought together a really interesting and eclectic group of people, and it was special. It was special in a way. It wasn't a commercial thing like it is now. It was felt like more of a movement or a club that not a lot of people wanted to be a part of, you know?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, the amount of people that obviously got into, you know, independent subculture, whether it was going down the road of, you know, punk and hardcore, whether it was just like embracing skateboarding for all it was worth. Like, yeah, it is not, I mean, it's the same idea as like, you know, tattoos in the, you know, year of our Lord in 2023. Like, that's not edgy at all. Like, everybody has a tattoo, but at one point that was edgy, where it's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you would do that to your, you know, arm or your face or whatever.
Yeah.
And so as you were, you know, kind of figuring out like what you were into from a musical perspective, and like you said, you were kind of, you know, picking up from the cues from your sister, and then obviously once you got into skateboarding, that revealed itself more. I find it, you know, absolutely insane that you were, you know, touring at that young age. Like, cause I mean, your first tour you did with Shotmaker was like when you were like 15, right?
Yeah. I turned I turned 16 on stage in Gilman Street in Berkeley. So.
did they sing happy birthday to you on stage?
No. I think they didn't know, but yeah, I our first tour, I was 15 when we left. Yeah, that's right. So for half of the tour, I was still 15. So yeah, it's ridiculously young. But Matt and Tim weren't that much older. I think Tim was 2 years older than me, maybe 17. Matt was the oldest. He could have been 18, 19. Still like super young to be on tour. Yeah,
absolutely. Because I like you started to tour in high school as well. And like I was, you know, probably 16 or 17 when I first started to tour. But just that idea of going to your parents and saying, hey, I'm going to be traveling. I mean, for you, like literally to a different country.
Yeah.
And so as you started to, you know, play in Shotmaker and obviously, you know, play shows and bring this stuff home, that was probably pretty weird to your parents. Like, how were they interacting with you, you know, getting into this stuff?
So my sisters had all left home by that time. My mom had divorced my dad and it was just me and her. And she had a new boyfriend at that time. So I think she was probably okay with getting the, you know, having the space. She was more of a good friend than a, you know, a stereotypical mom. So she kind of viewed herself as like, a friend rather than someone there to, I don't know what would be, yeah, someone there to be sort of more of an authoritative figure. She was very supportive. And our tours were, I guess, kind of, they were long enough for us, I guess, 6 weeks. So we would go away for 6-7 weeks. And as you said, to a new country, coast to coast, you know, down the seaboards, you know, across the bottom, back across the top. They were long tours. And for myself being a parent now, like I could not imagine letting my child at 15 do something like that. It was a different world back then, though. It wasn't like, I mean, the world's always been scary and in conflict, but I think it's quite a different place now. So there was a bit more, there was a sense of a little more freedom in a way, and than there is now, I think. And I can't quite put my finger on that. I would have to think about that a bit more. But it felt like the world was open a little more and it was more free to go out. And it was, not, I don't know if it was safer, but it was just different, right?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, you know, I'm sure you would, as you were traveling, you would, you know, call your mom like once a week and be like, oh, I'm here. Like, I'm excited to share this. Like, whereas now, obviously, everybody is connected all the time at any particular juncture. And so it was kind of like probably that idea of, oh yes, like Nick's going to summer camp for 6 weeks. Like I'm not going to talk to him. And like, that's fine.
Yeah.
And so with that decision of, cause I know like, is Shotmaker ostensibly like your first band or did you play in something prior to that?
I played in a little band before, but you wouldn't have heard of them. And then Tim from Herbal Scream at that time, mm-hmm. and I would play in my bedroom, and we would write music together. So Tim and I were playing guitars together, you know, a year before Shotmaker started, and we would just like sit on our amps in my bedroom and just kind of really just hatch out parts and have fun and you know, really non-committal. So I had been playing probably for about 18 months before I was in Shotmaker. But yeah, Shotmaker was my first real band for sure.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different things that stress us out, right? Like maybe it's something really, really small, like, man, that parking space, it's always taken. And I wish that I would be able to like get it instead of, you know, this person that maybe, you know, is the most courteous and considerate. I know that's something very random, but it's true. We all experience different things throughout the day that trigger us in so many different ways. And there are many times where I have been like, I wish that I had a spot or a repository for me to, you know, get this stuff off of my chest. Because if you bottle it up, that is no bueno. And then all of a sudden you explode on a coworker or a friend or a family member being like, the parking spot. And people are like, what are you talking about? That is where therapy comes in. And I love working with BetterHelp because I'm a huge advocate for therapy, broadly speaking. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, please give BetterHelp a try. It is so easy because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire and then you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you are not vibing with the therapist for any reason, you can switch it out at no additional charge. Get things off of your chest with BetterHelp. So visit betterhelp.com/Ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/Ray. New year, new you, new wardrobe. How about you go to our friends at rockabilly.com? You knew it was coming, right? Heck yes, Rockabilly is back with a vengeance on this show, and I love them for that. But first and foremost, use this promo code, 100 words or less, that gets you 10% off of your entire order. And right now, they have some incredible deals going on. We're talking about 70% off some pieces of merch. Like, you can probably get a free t-shirt with this promo code. Holy moly. But Rockabilia sells officially licensed band merch from bands all up and down the spectrum, whether it's Iron Maiden, AC/DC, Kiss, Slipknot, Motorhead. They traffic in all officially licensed stuff. That means the bands get paid. They sell you good quality merchandise. Everybody wins in this scenario, including you if you use the promo code 100 words or less. Again, rockabilly.com. Use the promo code. It ships from the Midwest here in the United States of America, and it gets you lickety-split. You can do it for, you know, your brother, your sister, your aunts, your uncles, your mom, your dad. Like, you know, say your dad's super into Led Zeppelin. Boom, here you go. Here's an officially licensed t-shirt. How about that? As I'm ordering my Bring Me the Horizon t-shirt. Anyways, rockabilly.com. Thank you so much for your continued support. And on with the show.
The idea of, like, I mean, because I presume that most of the touring you were doing, especially at that age, was like in the summers, like when you weren't in school, like you weren't actually having to drop out of school to like play in the band. Or did you, like, basically, I mean, like you said, you didn't concentrate on school because once the band came into play, it was like, oh yeah, this is all I want to care about. How did you, I guess, navigate both those things?
We toured in the summer. So we would do 6-week tours in the summer. I was always registered and enrolled in school. But later on, like Shotmaker was around like for three and a half years, something like that. And later on, in the band's, you know, time, active years, we would play a lot of shows. So it wasn't just the tours in the summer. Like we would, you know, on March break, we would do like a East Coast Canada tour, or it feels like every weekend or every other weekend we were driving down to Philly or you know, somewhere else along the seaboard to play. So we were, you know, we were putting in a lot of shows a year. I couldn't guesstimate how many, but like it wasn't just condensed to those touring periods. It was, we were playing like every weekend for sure. So that's why high school seemed kind of hard. I would be knocking off a Friday so I could, you know, get in the car and drive down to a show in Philadelphia or something like that, you know, or Detroit, or, you know, all the places that are kind of close to the Canadian border. We would kind of jump and play a lot of shows there, as well as places in Canada. You know, we'd be playing in Toronto or Montreal or those places as well. So how did I juggle it? I don't know. Always registered in school, you know, got through it. But yeah, the majority of the long tours were in the summer. And those were all, it's such a different time. Like going back to, I mean, you've mentioned it a couple of times, the pre-internet days. You know, our tours, we got this book called Book Your Own Fucking Life by Maximum Rock and Roll. And it was basically an alphabetical list of venues from state to state and city to city. And so Tim and I, like, I took, you know, the south of the states and the western seaboard, and Tim took the north of the states and the eastern seaboard, and we split everything up and we just called and, you know, sent demo tapes into promoters and you know, booked our first tour that way. So it was playing shows, but it was also like promoting the music, getting the music out there. You know, we were rehearsing like at least 3 times a week, sometimes more. So yeah, it really took all of my, school took a backseat for sure. Yeah.
Right, right. And when you, I know that obviously the band, you know, collectively relocated to Ottawa in order for you. And was that after you had finished high school, or was that like you were still in school?
I was still in school. So that would have been grade 11 for me.
Okay.
And Tim, our guitar player, was studying a journalism program at Carleton University. And, you know, we loved Ottawa. We had played there quite a lot. We had there was a great punk scene in Ottawa, like great punk scene. A lot of fantastic people like Sean Scallon. There was a new space called Five Arlington that had just started up. You know, Yannick Lorraine from Union of Uranus was there, like all these amazing people. And our guitar player was going to university there. And we're like, let's just go. Let's move to Ottawa. Let's figure this out. So Matt and I, the drummer and I, got a like a small apartment, and Tim got a, you know, was living in the dormitory at school, or residence, whatever it's called. And we moved to Ottawa. I registered in high school, and I finished my last 2 years of high school in Ottawa. Yeah.
Got it. And were you, like you said, so you were just basically like living together, you know, with the band, and ostensibly just being like, I am literally on my own. Like, it's not to say that you're were cut off from your parents or anything like that, but you were just on this adventure.
Yeah. Yeah. We were all in, 100% in. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned some of the, you know, bands like, you know, Union of Uranus, and I know like a lot of interesting things were happening. I mean, not only in Montreal, but, you know, I know with Sean and everything that was happening in Ottawa, because Ottawa is always, at least from what I've noticed on the outside and like playing some shows there throughout the years, mm-hmm. shout out to Club Saw, the idea of that scene in particular was always, you know, more indie rock leaning as opposed to like, you know, the heavier sides of either Toronto or Montreal. When you guys started to establish yourselves there, like, did you feel that kind of like, you know, college town vibe, for lack of a better term?
Yes, I know what you're talking about. And so Sean would do like good shows at you know, through the university, but in big sort of halls like Porter Hall at the university. But he would put on bands like Fugazi and things. So like, you know, those larger format venues that are kind of college town, but, you know, he would put on good music. But I think what made the real shift for that was Five Arlington. So Five Arlington was a, you know, a small space. It was you know, just run by punks. People lived there. It was also, you know, sold records, sold scenes. People rehearsed there. I think we rehearsed there for a little bit too. And lots of shows. And that venue really changed that dynamic. That venue was really, it was very much so punk, hardcore music of that time. And, you know, all the bands coming out of there, like Uranus, Okara, us, that was our orbit. That was really our orbit. That's where we hung out. That's where we spent time. A lot of us rehearsed there. It was kind of the heartbeat. So I think that venue shifted that college town context you're talking about.
Yeah. And I think it was too, probably when you started to bounce off of one another, as far as like, you know, playing those shows and having all of these different inputs and bands coming from out of town and playing, like you said, kind of at the beginning of the conversation, just the energy and you being able to like have these different inputs, not only musically, was then, you know, it created more momentum in that scene, I'm sure.
100%. It was this, it was the zeitgeist. It was, you know, things were happening and people were responding to it, and we were building something together. It wasn't, you know, one, yeah, there was multiple influences coming into it for sure.
Yeah. You guys also, it seemed to me, I mean, even though the band only existed for, you know, 3.5 years, which, you know, in kid time feels like 400 years or whatever, but, not to rip off the band name from that same genre, but you had a very workhorse like attitude where it's like, you know, like you said, you would sometimes practice twice a day. And, you know, there was that discipline that it seemed like you really focused on. And I know that there was enjoyment out of that, but you had that workhorse nature to it. Was that just kind of like hard baked in you guys since the get go? Or was that something where you're like, oh, we want to take it seriously, so of course we're going to dedicate more time to it?
It was hard baked into us. It was never our intention to like work so hard to make it big or anything. It was more for the music. I mean, we were generally like, we would derive so much pleasure from writing music and just, you know, making something. It was the creative process. It was addictive. The creative process is addictive. And that's what drove us to, you know, rehearse a lot. That's what drove us. And you know, it's like this double-edged sword, because the more you tour and the more you perform, you know, they say like one live show is worth 10, you know, 10 practices or something, right? You would get tighter and you would play off of each other's dynamics more, you know, the more you play live. And then you know, you come back and you rehearse and you'd write different types of songs. You'd write tighter songs. You'd write different melodies. So it was this perfect storm. And I think that's what we really tapped into, is just the creative process. That was the drive for us. That was the workhorse drive you're talking about.
Yeah. And I think it's the reason I found that, you know, so interesting and kind of emblematic of a lot of bands, like of that particular era, where it was like, you know, sometimes the only things that you could look for as far as, you know, totems or historical reference points, where it's like, oh yeah, like I could, you know, read about Black Flag rehearsing like, you know, 40 times a week or whatever, and you'd be like, oh, maybe we can do some version of that. But it's like, yeah, if you're just, you know, soaking up the energy from one another, you're like, why would we not practice twice a day? Like, of course.
Totally.
Yeah. And once you started to, you know, like play shows and obviously like get out there in front of people, I mean, you being the, you know, vocalist, I know everybody obviously contributed, but you know, there was a nature of you being front and center. Were you comfortable with that? Or did you have to, I guess, kind of like learn how to be comfortable with that?
It didn't bother me in the slightest. I mean, it's funny, 'cause like even now, teaching, like I teach in, like I'm a professor, I teach art to university students, and you know, I get nervous before I go in and do something like that. But when you're doing it, it's like you forget all of that and you just come alive and animate. And I think doing Shotmaker as young as I did really prepared me well for you know, what I do now, even, like, which is, you know, essentially performing. You know, you go up and you play, you feel the music, you open up, and time kind of stops for a while, and you go through this creative outlet, right? And the world stops and you just perform. And that's what I did, and that's kind of you know, what I learned through Shotmaker is, you know, to really take hold of the opportunity and that time that you have, and just perform your best. And I love that about Shotmaker. I mean, it was my most important education as a young person, is being in that band, for sure.
Yeah. Well, and I know that many people that I've had discussions with on this show would articulate the idea of exactly what you're speaking about, where you just learn these things that you're not ever, you know, writing down, where it's like, you know, the moment that you transact on, you know, a t-shirt, like you're learning about profit and loss statements and like all these things where you're like, no, I wasn't thinking about it in those terms, but like, technically, I guess I was, like, just understanding how you're putting all of these building blocks together.
Yeah. It's like, do we have gas or do we eat? Exactly.
Right. And that dovetails nicely into, you know, what you were talking about as far as like the long tours you guys did, you know, in the US and playing all over the country from that side of things. I know that you were obviously living, to your point, very hand to mouth, where it was like, oh yeah, we're maybe getting paid, you know, $50 to $100 a show at the most. Yeah. And, you know, subsisting on whatever was happening from a merch sales perspective as well. And I know you were obviously playing a lot of unconventional venues and, you know, definitely just like passing the jar around shows and stuff like that. Was, you know, were you just like simply, you know, surviving off of, you know, Top Ramen that you were stealing from, you know, gas stations or whatever? Was it very like, I guess, fraught from that side of things, or were you not even paying attention to that?
I haven't thought about this in many years, and I love this. Before, we took a little Coleman stove with us, and before we left, I remember we all had a shopping list, and I pick up two cases of Top Ramen noodles, and you know, Tim would get the baked beans, and you know, it just felt like Stand By Me in a way, like collecting all this stuff for our trip.
Right.
And then, some of the people we met taught us how to, you know, go to the back of bakeries and, you know, find good bread that was thrown out because it was past its expiry, you know, it's a day old. And so, you know, we did a bit of bagel dumpster diving and things like that.
Sure.
I would say, to tell you the truth, like the community of people that we met touring were just amazing. And they built this, they built this nature of generosity and friendship that I've never experienced. So anywhere we went and played a show, there was, you know, home cooked vegan meals waiting for us. There was real generosity and support. It wasn't just like showing up at a venue, playing and leaving. Like there was more. Like there was a real music movement happening, and it was very for people and not for profit, and very very real and very authentic. And it was beautiful. And so we didn't really worry about if we were going to eat or not, because it always just worked out. I mean, we kept an eye on the gas tank a little bit more, right? Because, you know, we were driving long distances, like, you know, sometimes 12 hours to the next show. And yeah, we would get, you know, $50 to $200 per show, depending on what show we were playing. But we did something pretty cool with our merch, like our t-shirts. Like we sold them like really inexpensively, like $5 a shirt. But like the word got out, like people could just bring their own shirts, and we just had our silk screen with us, and we would just silk screen people's t-shirts in the back of the van. You know, so you could bring a jacket, you could bring a, you know, anything you wanted and have it silk screened. So that's kind of what we did. And then we would, you know, go to the Value Village and just pick up like every type of shirt you could find. And, you know, so we weren't buying like these brand new shirts. We were repurposing shirts, and we used to sell a ton of shirts, and that really helps. I know you mentioned the merch, but that piece of the merch really helps, you know, being in control of the production of it and having that silk screen with us at that time. So that was a big help. Obviously selling records always helps too. But yeah, I don't know. I think we kept an eye on the gas tank more than anything, and the food just ended up working out. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, and I love the relic of that time period. I mean, it definitely existed in the early 2000s as well, as far as like what you're talking about with the idea of, you know, silk screening shirts at shows, or people just obviously buying blanks at a, you know, not even blanks, but just shirts from thrift stores. Yeah. And being like, oh yeah.
Or a Schweppes ginger ale shirt with the Shotmaker logo on the back. Yeah.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. So yeah, no, I definitely, there's a band called Yafet Kodo from out here, and I definitely have like a Italian restaurant t-shirt with the Yafet Kodo logo on the back or whatever. Yeah. But yeah, so funny where you're just like, wait, what the hell is this? But like people that know, and they're like, that's even cooler than, you know, obviously just like a random person wearing a Misfit shirt or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm going to guess like when you started to tour and you started to notice like these pockets of, you know, places where people were either already familiar with your music or were just like really, you know, embraced what you guys were doing. You know, where were those pockets that you started to notice, you know, beyond, obviously I know you've articulated this in other places where there's nothing that is sweeter than the hometown show after you've, you know, played for 6 weeks to places that people are just like, God, this band sucks. I don't have anything to do with them or whatever. Where were pockets like in the States, if you noticed anything?
You know, the first tour was like, we were just really finding our feet and finding our sound. So I think the second and third tour, we really, really responded well to like the Eastern Seaboard, like New York, Philly, DC, and even, you know, down like the Carolinas, like the music went over really well. I don't know. I had such a good experience through all of the states. I don't know. Cause even like the opposite, like Chicago and Wisconsin and, you know, all those places in that area, like the Midwest, like the music really did well. And, even down south, like Texas, you know, the music did really well. So that's a really hard question to answer. I don't feel like we played California quite a lot too. And I'm not sure California was maybe because the population is so dense and there's so much going on all the time, that might've felt a little less receptive at that time, but mm-hmm. that could have changed the last couple of years. Cause like, I know you brought up Abolition Records and your love of that. Like we'd stay with Kent McClard at his house and, you know, they would put on shows for us and that those were always really well received too. So I don't know, actually, you know, that's a hard question to answer. I think we were everywhere was kind of amazing and people were amazing everywhere we went. And
sure.
Maybe I wasn't super critical of it at that time, but I have fond memories of everywhere in the States. Like there was always someone that made it excellent. There was always a good conversation. There was always a good band we were playing with. There was always someone who was so nice to us offering us accommodation that's hard. I'm not sure, but we did go to the Eastern Seaboard mostly because being in Ottawa, you know, it's a straight shot down to, you know, Philly, New York, those kind of places.
Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
We have our friends EvilGreed.net are back, and they're awesome because they offer web store solutions for bands and record labels that you as a consumer benefit from by going to their website and shopping. It's a very simple transaction that happens. And speaking of simple transactions, if you use this promo code 100 words, it gets you 10% off of your entire order. And they have a very specific point of view in regards to the bands and record labels they work with. They're not just opening the doors wide open for everybody. They're basically like, yo, you heavy? Cool. You artistic? Cool. Like, this is my own checklist, you know, if I was putting myself in their shoes. And, you know, do you got cool looking merch? You sell vinyl? You want some, you know, hoodies? All of that they offer. This is just a small sampling of some of the bands they work with, whether it's Nails, Power Trip, Bellwitch, Deaf Heaven, Botch. Like, it's amazing stuff. And trust me in saying that if you listen to the show, you will absolutely find merch that you will be interested in. They operate out of Berlin, Germany, but they have worldwide shipping, and the shipping rates are advantageous to us right now in the States. That's why they're working with this podcast. So go to evilgreed.net, find your new piece of favorite merch, use the promo code 100 words, and you'll get 10% off your entire order.
I really like
everybody
how you
wins.
Describe that.
Thank you very much,
I
Evil Greed.
Think it is
now
a snapshot
on with the show.
Of moments, especially from a touring perspective, where it's like they're. Usually there is one, you know, redemptive thing about every show, whether it's like, it doesn't matter maybe if you played that well or you sold a lot of merch or whatever. Like, it's just those little moments of like, oh man, like, you know, the vegan chili was really good at, you know, in Milwaukee or whatever. Like, just something that you can latch onto. And then it kind of, you know, coats everything with that. Like, yeah, of course, you're going to look at everything through rose colored glasses with, you know, the older you get and the perspective starts to lean in. But just that idea of, you know, finding something of value that you were just like, I can't believe I'm out here doing this. This is crazy.
Yeah. I think what one year, and I think it might have been our first year, we played in, I think it was Sacramento, California, and we played two shows in one day. And the first show was an afternoon show. And then the second show, I think it, I could be mistaken, but I think it was at a person from Iconochrist's house, and maybe John Henry West was playing, and my mind was just blown, and there was like vegan burritos going around, and you know what I mean? Like all these stories and like going on tour, you never knew what you were going to encounter. Right. And I love that. I love the surprise of it all. Like you knew the bands you were going to play with, but you didn't know the depth of the people that were going to be there and the experiences you would have. It was just this never-ending kind of experience that just got deeper and better, you know, as we played more and as we did more shows and more tours. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And considering there was no logical case, I mean, you've said it obviously earlier in the interview of the fact that there was no idea of being like, oh yes, like we're going to make it big. And we're obviously there's no roadmap. Like even, you know, now where, you know, punk and hardcore and whatever else is like the largest it ever has been, you know, in the 90s, like clearly that was not, a roadmap unless you were obviously like Green Day or Rancid or whatever at that particular juncture. I presume that like when you were coming home, you're obviously just like, you know, going back to school, you know, working at local bagel shops or whatever, just, you know, probably just trying to put two and two together in order to get enough gas for, you know, the next tour or whatever.
100%.
And what were you personally like as you were coming home? Because, you know, you were a few years younger and were you actually like trying to go to college as well? Or were you just primarily focused on the band?
I was still in high school up until the band just, you know, broke up. So I would come back. I remember the best thing I would do after every tour is just take a bath by myself for hours and just get some time. Because I'm a bit of an introvert and you're always around people when you're, you know, touring. And I just remember coming back and decompressing. And then it was like nothing happened. Then you just start practicing again, start playing shows again on the weekends, start thinking about your next tour, start thinking about your next, you know, trying to get together 10 songs to think about a sequence for a record. Like the recordings too, like we didn't have much money, right? So even looking back at this re-release we did now, like Jesus, man, if I could turn back the clock a bit and just take more time with the recordings and, you know, found more money to spend more time in the studios, I would do it in a heartbeat. Cause we were such a live band with such a big sound. And I think we did an okay job of capturing it with the recordings, but I think so much more could have been done with them. And the lack of money, we would go in the graveyard shift to a studio, you know, record from midnight to 5 a.m. and do that for 2 days and put out a record, right? Like that was it. Like, 10 hours in the studio, maybe, with mixing, like, you know, you get your album done and that's it. Like that's the one thing I it wasn't the times though. I mean, we didn't have the money. No one had the money. Studios were these things for, labels and the elite. It was really, no one had Pro Tools at their house. You had to rely on an engineer. And, we also didn't, like at that time we were recording onto 2-inch tape, but we couldn't afford our own reels. So we would rent the tape from the studio and then they would kind of, after that was done, they would wipe it, I guess. I'm not sure.
But, right. Yeah.
That's how we recorded back then.
Yeah, absolutely. Tape was the most expensive thing. Like when you were recording, it was like, you know, yes, of course you were paying for the engineer's time, but then it would be like, oh my gosh, you'd like, you know, out of the $600, like 400 of it goes to the tape. Like, wow.
Yeah. So they would just let us rent it and then we would master to whatever we'd master to. And they would just wipe the tape because you can re-record over that tape a million times and not have any quality loss, I suppose.
Yeah, for sure. And when you guys started to, you know, interact with, you know, I'll put this in big air quotes as far as like the music industry, you know, like once you started to work with, you know, the record labels like Great American Steak, Religion, and Trouble Man, I know those were obviously friends of yours. So it wasn't like you were working with, you know, some big bad major label or anything like that. But as you guys started to, you know, transact with the music business, as it were, was that something that you were, you know, generally comfortable with? Or was that something where it was like, oh, this is weird. We got to deal with money and all this stuff like this. Like, I don't, you know, we just want to play in a band.
I think we were young and probably naive and didn't overthink it. And it worked out well for most of the records we did. So I think like none of them were money making ventures, right? It was all like, God, let's press 2,000 records, and because we're going on tour, and see if we can sell them, and you know, do mail order distribution and these things. So it was very much of just working with your friends, and it almost being like a collaboration of sorts. Like they put up the money and you kind of put up the work to help get the records out. So it wasn't overthought. I think we, you know, the last piece with Trouble Man could have, you know, probably put a little more thought into that, because we knew Mike, but we didn't know him well. And, you know, but all the other records were great. So one of our good friends who really was pivotal and instrumental in getting us out there, Dara Hayes, he put out our first, 45, or our first two 45s. And from there, you know, we met Yannick Lorraine, who put out our first album. And then through touring, we met some great people from the States. And they put out a split with Max, Mike, and Kobe, the Nervous Wreck Kids, people, and they, you know, we got along with them like a house on fire. So it was, you know, they were all really small kind of labels just doing what we were doing at that time, which was supporting a scene. I think, you know, the last two records went really well too, but I think Mike's great, but I preferred working with the other people, I guess. Yeah.
Sure. And then, you know, as the band came to a close, and, you know, I mean, they're obviously, especially at those times, it's so not volatile, but it's just like, there's a lot of times where it's just like, oh, people are going in different directions. And it's not like there's some huge, you know, blow up conversation where it's just like, all right, well, you know, sometimes it just fizzles out or whatever. Were you feeling, you know, after that was ending, because it was such a, you know, intense and focused time, were you feeling kind of like adrift on what is next, or did you immediately want to, you know, play in other bands after that, or what was your feeling as that was kind of ending?
So I think Matt and Tim say, when you ask them about how Shotmaker ended, they kind of say none of us knew it was ending. It just kind of ended. But like I moved to Toronto, and I feel like I split the band up when I left. And for me, it was going into the fourth summer, and we weren't going to go on tour that summer. And to me, I was like, well, we're not going to go on tour. Like what, like that's what Shotmaker is. Like we're a live band. And I kind of, I lost interest after that. Like I don't think I was interested in, I don't know why. It seems so like I was young, and maybe it was just a decision I should have taken more time with, but I moved to Toronto. I wasn't really interested. If we weren't going to go on tour, I wasn't interested in sticking around, kind of thing. And, when I moved to Toronto, I started playing in other bands. I played, I replaced a bass player in this band called Venus Cures All for a while. But then I really got into visual art and did my undergraduate degree, then graduate degree in visual arts. So I kind of knew that's what I wanted to do. And I think having my background, not I think, I know having a background in music just really transferred those skills so well to making art and understanding abstraction and understanding emotive charge with ideas. Music really set me up for, the headspace of visual art, the visual art world. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, especially too, where it's like when you participate in creative endeavors at a young age, whether it's, you know, playing an instrument, whether it's taking photos or whatever, it's like all of it just kind of, you know, brews in this you know, creative stew. And then only later on in life are you able to understand like, oh yes, like all of these things I put on top of each other led me to the point of being like, oh yeah, I think I can do this visual art thing or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Matt and Tim actually stayed on together and played in bands.
Yep.
Our band, Three Penny Opera.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, for sure.
After. So they very much stayed on together, but I left. I left the city. I left Shopmaker. Yeah.
Yeah. And how was your experience, like, you know, as you were, you know, growing up and obviously entering the, you know, professional workforce and doing everything that you have been doing, you know, since the band, you know, broke up, like, did you stay connected to music? Like, do you still, you know, care about that side of things? I mean, I know that you obviously care about the music that you created in Shopmaker, but what was your relationship with, you know, the more independent music stuff as you were growing up?
I mean, when I left, I really, I was focusing on a visual arts practice. So I've had a long career of museum and gallery exhibitions, sort of nationally and internationally. And I've been, you know, teaching ever since. So I always found creativity in my life, and music's always been a big part of that. A lot of the projects I write, if they're films or large installations, I'll, you know, write into the project and the budget that I'll, you know, write a score for the piece. Music's always with me. If your question was more like, did I keep up with following bands and going to shows? I mean, somewhat, but not like my focus was kind of, you know, redirected into making objects and images, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And it's like, it's not, you know, disparaging people as they, you know, evolve and looking or finding their inspiration in other places. But it's just like, you know, sometimes that is just always a part of like, oh yeah, maybe I go to one or two shows a year, but like, I'm always, you know, it's always lingering in my head.
I think when I moved to Toronto, I was in a couple of bands, probably for, you know, a few years after that, actually three bands for a few years after that, but nothing like Shopmaker. As I was saying before, we had this chemistry between the three of us. It really clicked and worked well. And the bands I was in Toronto, were, you know, they were fine, but it never clicked with me. It never felt the same, and it wasn't as engaging to me. And I don't know why, but it wasn't as interesting to me for some reason. I don't know what that all means, but
yeah. No, I totally understand what you're saying. It's like, I mean, when you try to do other creative things and then like, it just doesn't feel like the thing that you know, either grew up with or so comfortable with. It's just like, I mean, this is fine, but it's just not the thing I really enjoy doing. So yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah.
A few last things. The, I guess the largest show that, you know, you probably played was maybe like, you know, whatever, opening for Fugazi or something like that. But, you know, is there a show that sticks out, you know, a show or two that sticks out in your brain as far as being like, oh yeah, like this was such a big audience and, you know, something that we never experienced before playing, you know, in a pizza shop in front of 50 people, which was also great. But, you know, what was the larger shows that you played that stick out in your brain?
I guess you kind of nailed it with Fugazi. I mean, Montreal, Fugazi, probably, you know, 3,000 people. I'm guesstimating probably something like that, but that's, you know, huge, like huge.
For yeah. Sure.
And, you know, on a big stage, and we were not big stage people, but it was exciting. I mean, we were more used to like hearing our amps fill up the space, and those shows were very much about having a PA fill up the space. So, I guess it was exciting for us, but I preferred playing small venues with the amps, kind of warming up the space. It was all about people for me. When I was asked a question last night, we did this listening party, and I was asked a question like, what was your favorite show you ever played? And I just think any of the shows with Policy of Three, because, you know, we kind of ended up lining up on a tour schedule with them, 1 year, and we just became the best friends. And you like your friends and you support your friends. And that, like, any of those shows to me would, like, yeah, far stand out as more meaningful than, you know, playing with Fugazi to 3,000 people in Montreal. Yeah,
sure. Well, especially when you develop that, you know, sister band relationship, where it's like you then feel like you're part of the same pirate ship traveling around the country, and it's just like, it's indescribable. Even though you could be playing in front of five people, but it's just like, oh no, we're all here. It's great.
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah.
When did you, I guess, recognize the, you know, legacy of Shotmaker? And I'm maybe using that in air quotes because, you know, obviously you don't want to be too highfalutin about it. But that idea of, like, the Shotmaker name, you know, resonating longer, was it like when, you know, Trouble Man put out the discography, or like, when did you notice kind of that, like, oh, this is weird that people are still talking about this, you know, silly band I did for 3 years in the 90s. Like, this is weird.
Yeah, it was after the Trouble Man discography. Like, I always knew we were special. Like, I didn't hear, there was nothing that sounded like us. And we had this energy that, you know, I hadn't really seen anything quite like it before. So I knew as on a personal level that it was special to me. But honestly, I think just later on, like 10, 15 years after Shotmaker broke up, like, you know, as I said, I am an artist, and, you know, having solo exhibitions in at galleries in places like Washington, D.C., and you're walking down the street and someone's like, were you in Shotmaker? And you're like, oh, yeah, I was, you know, and times like that, like, people notice you. And I always sloughed it off to, oh, well, we played a lot of shows, so someone probably just recognizes me. But, you know, the younger generation, like, I have some students even that, you know, they're on Discogs and they're following, you know, this kind of music and 90s music. And, you know, they know Shotmaker, and that kind of blows me away, you know, like,
sure,
the coincidence where, you know, it's 10 years later and someone might have recognized you, to now it's, you know, close to 30 years later. It's 30 years. The band started, I guess, 30 years ago. 2019. Yeah. Or sorry. 1993.
Sure.
To now. And, you know, having the new generation engaging with that music, and that to me says something. I mean, so I think it makes me very happy that, so, you know, some people are thinking the music has stood the test of time. It makes me very proud to think of that. So I'm happy that whatever the little piece of magic that I thought we had, I'm happy other people feel that too.
Sure. And I'm sure, to your point too, like, it comes in waves, where it's just like, you know, like, nothing could happen, then all of a sudden it's like you have two random experiences in 1 week, and it's just like, oh, like, that wow. And then, yeah, like you said, just these ideas, the fact that this moment in time can be encapsulated not only in a discography, but it's just like people could still dip into it and find value in it. Whereas, like, other times you can listen to something that, you know, came out in the early 90s and be like, oh, this sounds like, you know, garbage cans being thrown down a hallway, which I'm sure in some respects you're like, oh yeah, like, that's what our records sound like. No, just kidding. But just that idea, like, it can pick that person up that is, you know, 17 years old and, like, you know, retroactively getting into all of these, you know, 90s bands. It's cool.
Yeah. And Ray, you know, when I started the Instagram account and last March, so, you know, not quite a year ago, but just hearing the response, like, I'd have younger people responding to the pictures saying, oh, I heard about you through this, and I, you know, I'm really trying to find the music. And, you know, it was before You know, we posted anything to digital platforms, like streaming platforms. And that kind of really stuck with me too. Like the younger generation responding to this type of music, I think it's great. I really do. Cause a lot of this music is obscure. And like for Shotmaker, we just kind of left it dead and buried, you know, for a long time until, Solid Brass reached out to us and they wanted to do something, and they really seemed like, we had, you know, several conversations and they seemed like great people. And we were like, okay, let's do it. And I started this Instagram account, and just the flood of memories and histories and stories and people sharing images with me to post. I guess that really drove it home too. That like how special this band was to other people, to see their interaction with that, with the Instagram account. Yeah.
How about that? Great discussion with Nick from Shotmaker. And like I said, you need to listen to Shotmaker. If you have not checked them out for whatever reason, go to your favorite streaming service, or even better, buy their discography. There's seriously no skips, as the kids would say. But there's a link in the show notes to where you can visit Solid Brass Records and buy that discography. It's a beautiful box. It puts the band in appropriate context, and you kind of see the evolution of the band over time. And my personal favorite is their Crayon Club LP. Holy moly, that thing smokes. So thank you very much to Nick, and thank you very much to Solid Brass Records for helping put this together. Next week, we're keeping it in Canada. I have a great episode with Jesse Mathewson. I realize that I haven't said his name out loud, but Jesse Mathewson plays guitar and lead vocals in Ken Mode. If you have not listened to Ken Mode, talk about a beast of a band. They've existed for over 20 years now. And Jesse's just a great hang. He works in the music industry as far as like business management and all that sort of stuff. So we had a ton to talk about. That's what's happening next week. And until then, please be safe, everybody. The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
It's the Breakfast Club, the world's most dangerous morning show.
Hey!
Angela Yee is kind of like the big sister that always pokes you in the forehead.
It's my show.
Ooh. That's not how it goes?
That's not how anything goes.
Yemi's really like a robot. One of the best DJs ever.
Believe that!
Charlamagne is the wild card.
And I'm about to give somebody the credit they deserve for being stupid.
I know, that's right.
What is wrong with you?
Listen to the Breakfast Club weekday mornings from 6 to 10 on 106.7 The Beat. Columbus's real hip-hop and R&B.